Blog Talk Radio.
Profits, but its federal income tax rates dropped during those years
is just 1.1%. 1.1. So the point is, if you go out and you work for a living, you pay taxes. 10-15% of your income taxes. But if you're on Wall Street, if you're a major oil company, if you have lobbyists all over this place, not only can you avoid paying any taxes, in many cases you'll actually get a tax refund from the IRS. So what's the point? The point is that at a time when we have a $1.6 trillion deficit, maybe we have to reduce that deficit, not simply on the backs of working families, low-income people, the children, the sick, the elderly. Maybe we might want to call for shared sacrifice. Maybe ExxonMobil and some of the large oil companies might be asked to pay something in taxes. Maybe General Electric might be asked to pay something in taxes. Maybe the wealthiest people in this country might be asked to pay something in taxes. Madam President, these are serious times for our country. We need serious answers. We need shared sacrifice. Thank you, and with that, I would yield the floor.
Yeah.
Well, he makes a lot of sense.
Well, he's bringing it out anyway, and, you know, whether he
can sustain it
or you get anybody who...
up on his bandwagon, I don't know about that.
Yeah, because, you know,
they're all remarkably quiet.
Yeah, because they're all getting paid by these operations. And the minute they get paid by them, you got to remember, the minute they do a favor for them, they've locked in a job for themselves once they get out of the Senate, or once they get out of the, you know, Congress.
Be a lobbyist.
Yeah, be a lobbyist. Get them, you know, $100 million a year. Unbelievable. This was a fascinating thought. And UK government recruits doctors to become thought police. Okay, pinpoint potential terrorists among their patients. Now, outrageous new counterterrorism measures being proposed in the UK are receiving a public relations backlash because of their extreme fascist overtones. The UK government's Prevent program, which allegedly claims to protect against terrorism, is being reformulated to recruit doctors to both spy on their patients, then report to the authorities those patients suspected of becoming potential terrorists.
Well, how are you going to tell that? By the color of their eyes?
Yeah, an incomplete contradiction to the private doctor-patient relationship. The new proposals encourage doctors to identify and target patients whom they believe to be vulnerable to being drawn into terrorism and report them to government authorities. Naturally, the UK's Muslim community stands to be targeted, and most under the new guidelines, as doctors who participate in the programs will likely falsely accuse and report many of their Middle Eastern patients as potential terrorists. Now, I don't know why they would bother doing that, or why they, you know, you go to a doctor.
Because they work for the government, government doctor.
Yeah.
In complete contradiction to the private doctor, such heinous actions, of course, are akin to what took place in Nazi Germany during the Holocaust. Except they may be even worse, as they presume guilt upon innocent individuals before any actual crime has even occurred. A doctor's mere perception that a patient may one day become a terrorist or may be susceptible to becoming one based on perceived personality trait is enough to get the patient reported to authorities under the new proposals. According to the UK's Guardian, Home Secretary Theresa May has not only laid out the proposed guidelines, but she has also attempted to diffuse criticism of the plan by expanding the scope of potential terrorist profiting to include animal rights extremists and those on the far right of the political spectrum, similar to tactics routinely used by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the U.S. Transportation Security Administration. The British government's new counterterrorism scheme is nothing more than a flimsy false flag excuse to exert more power and control over the British people. The game is simple: invent a boogeyman, scare the people with it, and propose increased security measures that strip innocent citizens of their privacy and freedom.
Yep.
And that is from Natural News, and it was by Ethan A. Hunt.
That's kind of a scary thing. That's happening there. That's this one is kind of interesting. I'd like to play this. So IMF rolls out $3 billion bailout to push Mubarak's men to the top of the pyramid. In other words, to push Mubarak's former government back into power.
Yep.
All right. And this is by Russian TV, so it's only 3 minutes, so we'll just take a look at this one.
International bankers have agreed to rescue the ailing Egyptian economy. 4 months after blacklisting former President Mubarak's regime, Cairo's reeling from the revolution that toppled the leader, but the military that once propped up his rule is still running the country. RT's Paul Asliat reports now on fears that the cash will be swallowed up by the same old players.
As if the International Monetary Fund doesn't have enough on its plate, it's agreed to loan $3 billion to Cairo. A move critics say is absurd.
I think this is a bribe that the West is trying to give to the regime, lest the new one, lest it turns against the West.
But Cairo's insisting the money will help stabilize the country's finances, especially now with Mubarak gone and the country going through a transitional period. But observers say it's the same spin, with only slightly different marketing.
These agreements are being made with transitional governments. And these transitional governments have, they come primarily from figures of the old regime. They're composed primarily of figures from the old regime. For example, Samir Radwan, the finance minister in Egypt who's been negotiating this loan, was a Mubarak appointee.
Obama is promising Cairo $1 billion more in loan guarantees, and on top of that, another $1 billion in debt cancellation. While French President Nicolas Sarkozy has committed the G8 to providing up to $10 billion in direct aid. It's a commitment the West says it's making to help Egyptians get back on their feet.
The United States and the West are trying to reduce the damage caused by the revolutions via considerable financial contributions to the Egyptian economy.
And the perfect way is through the IMF, which is heavily influenced by the United States.
For many, many years, the IMF has been considered as an arm of American foreign and economic policies, and this aid to a regime that is unstable could be considered as a waste of money on something that is very shaky.
What's more, it comes with particular strings attached, and that the deal could in fact spell trouble.
The leaders of Egypt will no longer run their country if they accept an IMF loan. And the more money they accept, the worse trouble they will get themselves in. A country literally loses its sovereignty to Western bankers and other predatory corporations. There is no way that an IMF loan can help a country.
What most Egyptians fear is that the money will get used up long before it reaches their pockets, believing it's likely to be only a small elite, as well as international banks, who will benefit from the loans. The last time the IMF injected a large amount of money into Egypt was 20 years ago. But since then, the number of Egyptians living below just $2 a day doubled. In February this year, the IMF praised the Mubarak regime's sound fiscal management in Egypt. As far as Libya went, it said the outlook for the economy remained stable. But just days later, Mubarak was ousted and Tripoli was engulfed in anti-Gaddafi demonstrations. So it's no surprise that many say the better the IMF rates the country, the closer that country is to having a revolution, highlighting just how wrong the organization can be. Paul Asliat, RT, Tel Aviv.
So basically, they're trying to bribe the leaders of Egypt.
Yeah.
To force them into, losing their sovereignty, and that's putting the old Mubarak boys. Pretty sick shit. Okay. This one cracked me up because I know the story about this guy, and I've heard it. He's been around for quite a while, and he's a former CIA guy. It says CIA's Bin Laden Hunter ordered to stand down 10 times. Michael Schur, former chief of Central Intelligence Agency's Osama Bin Laden unit, was told the UK Telegraph in a recent interview he was prevented from capturing or killing the terrorist by his superiors on at least 10 separate occasions. The 22-year CIA veteran turned whistleblower resigned from the agency in 2004, disgusted by the government's lies surrounding the terror war. He's been embarrassing the U.S. ever since. So, I think I've read some of this guy's stuff before, but I don't want to. Yeah, this is the John Birch paper.
Mm-hmm.
I'm American.
Yeah.
In 1995, Shure was elected to lead the spy agency's bin Laden efforts. By then, the militant Islamist was exiled in Sudan, and after angering Saudi authorities, bin Laden was running several businesses in the African nation that Shure suggested disrupting. We formulated operations and submitted them for approval, but they would not approve any of them, and the ex-CIA official told the Telegraph, if we had been able to deal with serious economic blow, it could have been a showstopper. And the next year, bin Laden declared a war on the American government. In 1997, when bin Laden was again living in Afghanistan, Shure said his team groomed a band of Afghans to capture the suspected terror boss. And there were at least two clear opportunities to bring down bin Laden by the middle of 1998, according to Shure. But in both cases, he said, CIA bosses refused to proceed. And in August of that year, bin Laden's al-Qaeda network bombed two American embassies in Africa. Bin Laden said the embassy in Nairobi, Kenya, was targeted for serving as a U.S. intelligence hub for the CIA. And the attacks killed numerous U.S. diplomats and at least two CIA agents, according to the Associated Press. Shure told the Telegraph that following the missed opportunities to kill or capture bin Laden in 1998, there were at least eight other chances to get the terror mastermind. But by that point, bin Laden was supposedly among the U.S. government's most wanted criminals. But for some unknown reason, senior officials refused to authorize his capture or the assassination. I don't know if you want to read the rest of this.
Okay. Just
point
out where we are.
150-cent round.
150-cent round could have put us all out of our agony, Shure explained, but that didn't happen. At high level, authorities consistently ordered the CIA unit not to stop bin Laden. In 1999, Shure told the paper that he sent an angry letter to higher-ups demanding to know why his men were risking their lives for somebody the U.S. government did not seem to want to stop. I don't know what you're doing when you talk to the president, but he will not get a better opportunity than this, Shure explained to his superiors. Eventually, the bin Laden unit chief, Shure, was dismissed from his position before being reinstated after the September 11th attacks. A few months after that, the U.S. government and its allies had bin Laden surrounded in the mountains of Tora Bora in Afghanistan, but yet again, high officials let him escape. A Senate investigation from 2009 explained some of the details in its summary. With bin Laden trapped, calls for reinforcements to launch an assault were rejected. Requests were also turned down for U.S. troops to block the mountain pass leading to sanctuary a few miles away in Pakistan, the document states. The vast array of American military power was kept on the sidelines. And according to the report, the decision not to capture or assassinate bin Laden, or at least cut off his escape route, was made by then-Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and his top commander, General Tommy Franks. Despite subsequent Bush administration protestations to the contrary, the review of existing literature, unclassified government records, and interviews with central participants underlying this report removes any lingering doubt and makes it clear that Osama bin Laden was within our grasp at Tora Bora, the Senate report concluded.
And more than a few other reports, examples of bin Laden being deliberately allowed to escape by senior officials in the United States and other governments, but surfaced over the last decade. But according to this current version of President Obama's ever-changing narrative, the terror leader was finally shot through the head by U.S. forces after being found unarmed in a hideout in Pakistan. His body was then supposedly dumped in the ocean for unknown reasons. But questions continue to plague the government on almost every front. Since resigning over government lies, Sure, in particular, has been a persistent thorn in the side of the American officials. He has published several widely acclaimed books criticizing U.S. policies, including Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror, and Marching Toward Hell, America and Islam After Iraq. And he regularly makes inflammatory statements in media appearances and speeches, too.
Mm-hmm. Last month, speaking in the U.K., Shura said American and British officials, including Obama and Prime Minister David Cameron, don't have a clue about the terror war or what is going on in the West. The main recruitment sergeant for al-Qaeda is Barack Obama, he charged. According to Shura, there's nothing to do with America's rapidly vanishing freedom, as the government continues to claim. We are being attacked in the West, and we will continue to be attacked in the West as long as we are in Afghanistan, as long as we support the Israelis, as long as we protect the Saudi police state, Shura told the crowd. They can't cope with the fact that it's nothing to do with the way we live. It doesn't have anything to do with elections or democracy or liberty. He asserted that the war was being attacked,
or the West.
The West was being attacked for supporting fascism across the Middle East and not so-called gender equality or any such notions.
In the recent past, Shura also accused the U.S. government's 9/11 commission of deliberately hiding the truth about the attacks. It was a whitewash and a lie from top to bottom, he told Fox News Judge Andrew Napolitano. And numerous lawmakers and high-level officials have made various allegations about why it took the government 10 years to get bin Laden. Representative Morris Hinchey of New York, for example, accused that President George W. Bush of intentionally allowing bin Laden to elude capture to justify the invasion of Iraq. And as the New American reported recently, bin Laden, his al-Qaeda network, and other Islamic extremists have indeed enjoyed a sort love-hate relationship with the American government for decades. And even now, the Obama administration and the United States are backing an insurgency in Libya against its former ally, Muammar Gaddafi. And where certain leadership elements are known to be affiliated directly with al-Qaeda and related groups.
Why high-ranking officials in the U.S. government would have let bin Laden escape so many occasions is certainly a matter that should be investigated by the press and authorities. Speculation has been running rampant for years, but unfortunately for Americans, analysts don't expect serious inquiries to happen anytime soon.
Yep.
And who was that article by?
That was by Alex Newman, and it was in the New American.
Yeah, it was a good, well-written.
Yeah, that's... New American is the John Birch Society, just so you know.
Facebook quietly snitches on facial recognition tech by default.
Yeah, let me go to that because it's kind of serious. They're playing games and didn't tell anybody.
And what magazine is this from? Or?
The Register.
And where is that out of?
No idea. Huh. Not sure. But anyway, it's called The Register. By Kelly Fiveash. Facebook has rolled out its facial recognition technology to countries outside of the U.S. Excuse me. But have switched the feature on by default without telling its users first. UK-based security expert Graham Cooley, noted earlier today that Facebook had slotted the tech into the social network.
Without anybody knowing,
yeah. The Mark Zuckerberg-run company started using its facial recognition software in December last year for its stateside users in a move to
automatically provide tags
for the photos uploaded by
Facebook
right.
users. The tech works by scanning newly uploaded pics and then identifies faces from previously tagged photos already stored in Zuckerberg's internet silo. When the software was introduced in the U.S. late last year, Facebook pointed out that users could disable the function. If for any reason you don't want your name to be suggested, you will be able to disable suggested tags in your privacy setting, the company wrote on its blog post last December. But now the new that the tech has reached other shores, Facebook clearly didn't feel the need to alert its international database that its facial recognition software had been switched on by default within the social network. The suggest photos of me to my friends feature in question is located in the company's privacy settings. Facebookers need to click on customize settings before being able to assess the function and disable it if they so wish. Unfortunately, once again, Facebook seems to be sharing personal information by default. Many people feel distinctly uncomfortable about a site like Facebook learning what they look like and using that information without their permission, said Cooley. Most Facebook users still don't know how to set the privacy options safely, finding the whole system confusing. It's even harder, though, to keep control when Facebook changes the settings without your knowledge. He said Facebook shouldn't require its users to constantly check their privacy settings to see what the company has changed since the last visit to the site. The onus should not be on Facebook users having to opt out of the facial recognition feature, but instead on users having to opt in, he said. Yet again, he feels like Facebook is eroding the online privacy of its users by stealth. The Register asked Facebook to comment on this story, but at the time of writing, they had not gotten back.
Right, and they probably won't. So
you can hold your breath for that one.
I haven't seen this one on Facebook yet, so this is new. Okay.
What are you doing now, Leo?
I just wanted to another Facebook.
Well,
tell me, I need to do. Okay. What I just did is I was posting on Facebook this article, sharing it on Facebook. Facebook quietly switches on facial recognition tech.
So people that see your site can recognize
that's
that
right.
Facebook has a problem.
That's right. And
maybe we have some audio we could play, Leo, if you go back.
Yeah, I do. I just wanted to make sure I had that one there. I also want to read this thing about the new scanners they're coming up with. It's a little too long. Bear with me, folks, here until I see if I can get another. Hang on. I got a kick out of this one by the today. Lay off Dan Malloy in 214. This is by Connecticut. Connecticut Public Banking. So that was kind of cool. Alright, and
yeah.
Here's another one. This is not a second. I don't have too many videos for anybody tonight, but I wanted to read this. Japan doubles radiation leak estimate, all right, as today, came out yesterday. Japan's Nuclear Safety Agency has more than doubled its estimate of the amount of radiation released into the atmosphere from the crippled Fukushima nuclear plant. And plutonium believed to have come from the plant has also been found in a town near the facility. First time plutonium has been found in soil outside the facility. The Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency said it believes the earthquake-stricken Fukushima plant emitted nearly 800,000 terabecquerels. Terabecquerels.
I'm not sure what that is.
Of radioactive material into the air in the day after it was hit by a massive tsunami. And that is more than double the original estimate and is based on new information suggesting the number one and two reactors suffered meltdowns much earlier than thought. And the revision reveals the failure to contain the disaster resulted in much more radioactive contamination of the soil, sea, and air than the plant's operators had acknowledged. The disaster is rated at maximum 7 on an international nuclear accident scale and same level as the Chernobyl meltdown 25 years ago. The plutonium was found in the town of Okuma and is less than 2 kilometers from the plant. By analyzing the isotopes, the plutonium researchers have able to confirm it was emitted from the crippled facility. It is the first time plutonium from the planet has been found beyond its parameter. Where am I here? The researchers say that the amount detected is lower than the average level usually observed in Japan after a fallout from nuclear tests abroad.
Late last month, it was feared two workers at the crippled nuclear plant were exposed to radiation above the level allowed in emergencies. Japanese media reported that the Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, workers were exposed to at least 250 millisieverts of radiation. The maximum dose used to be 100 millisieverts, but it was raised to 250 after the nuclear crises began. It is believed the men were exposed while working in the plant's central control room outside the reactor buildings. Internal exposure occurs when people take radioactive substance into their bodies, tainted air, or food and drink. Media reporters say the workers were found with levels of radiational iodine in the thyroid glands 10 times higher than their fellow workers. TEPCO says it has been measuring the internal exposure to radiation of employees involved in the emergency work at the Fukushima Daiichi plant, crippled by the March 11th earthquakes and tsunami.
Okay. So I thought that was an interesting one. And let's see. Here's one that's kind of interesting. This guy was a SWAT team busts into a house over student loan fraud.
Oh, good.
Yeah. This is from Raw Story. And I don't know what to make of this one at all because it was sent to me. It was really fascinating. It says, and there's a video here, but it says, acting in orders from the U.S. Department of Education, a SWAT team broke into a California home Tuesday at 6 a.m. and roughed up a man because of his estranged wife's defaulted student loans, ABC News 10 reported. She wasn't there. As yet, Kenneth Wright of the city of Stockton was grabbed by the neck handcuffed before he and his three young children were put in a police car as the officer searched his house. He also told ABC News 10 that he said he was in his underwear the whole time. "They busted down my door for this. It wasn't even me," Wright told the local news station. "All I want is an apology for me and my kids, and for them to get me a new door." And local police were reportedly not involved in the incident. So here's the video. It's a video, but
we'll get the audio.
You get the audio portion. It's from Raw Story.
Now to a News 10 exclusive. A Stockton man wants an apology tonight for a wake-up call he should have never received. It is a story you'll only see on News 10. Lee Painter tells us why police and federal agents knocked down his door.
"This is what they did to my door.
At 6 this morning, a SWAT team surprised Kenneth Wright at his front door.
In my underwear. Before I get to the door, I hear him say, 'Hit it.' And I get ready to hit the door, and they hit the door. It almost hit me. So I said, 'Hold on.' They hit it again. I said, 'Hold on.'
But the SWAT team busted in, taking Wright.
They come grab me by my neck and drag me out my house to right there in the grass.
Thrown to the ground and handcuffed, law enforcement then searched his house.
And they put me in the backseat of a police car for over 6 hours. From 6 o'clock to 12:30, they had me handcuffed in the back of a police car with nothing on but my ripped-up underwear that they ripped in the yard."
Wright says they also woke his three children, holding them for 2 hours. But they failed to find their quarry, Wright's estranged wife. Wright later complained to Stockton's mayor and police, but the city pointed to the U.S. Department of Education.
"They say you owe a student loan, and you got to pay it. I just had my door kicked in because of this."
With the help of the Stockton Police Department, News 10 was able to contact one of the federal agents who was at the search this morning, who gave us a Washington, D.C. number for the Office of the Inspector General, who confirmed it was the Department of Education who conducted the search, but they can't discuss anything in the case until it's closed. Not even if it's policy to break in and handcuff people who default on student loans.
"They put this here and they said, 'We fixed the hole.' The hole is the least of my worries."
Wright says all he wants is an apology and a new door. And he has this warning to former students that the federal government's coming to collect in a big way.
people that have student loans out there or people that owe money, please pay your bills. Take care of your credit. If you don't believe me, this could be you one morning, 6 o'clock in the morning.
In Stockton, Lee Painter, News 10.
Well, Stockton police say federal agents requested one patrol car for the search. They reiterated that they did not kick in Wright's door or handcuff him and said he and his children were never held again.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of interesting.
So let's go on to the next one.
This one, from Ross story too, and I think this is really funny because he actually exposed Wiener.
Oh, lovely.
This is the guy who...
Dead enough, we get to look at his underpants.
Oh, and now they've exposed his wiener. The guy that actually sent pictures.
Naked pictures.
Although conservative publisher Andrew Brent initially promised to keep the most explicit picture of Representative Wiener to himself, barring certain actions by Wiener, an alleged picture of Wiener's naked erect penis nonetheless leaked out this morning. During an appearance on Sirius X Radio's notoriously raunchy program, The Opie and Anthony Show, Wednesday, showed the radio jock shocks, shock jocks, rather, the image that was saved on his phone. Although they now claim that they retrieved a still of the phone from a videotape of the show, and that Redart didn't allow them to photograph it, the original image now removed from YFrog showed a thumb in the corner of the lens as though it had been taken from a cell phone camera. And YFrog was the image sharing service to which Wiener sent the joke photo of him and his boxers that started the entire scandal. And the show tweeted the photo to its official account and brought it to the attention of the gossip sites. All right. And I have a picture of that. The guy sent it to me on Facebook. It was hysterical. But as a conservative provocateur told NBC's Matt Lauer Tuesday that he would release the photo if Anthony Wiener decided to make it a jihad against me. He says, I don't think I want to put his family through that type of thing. I could put that out there, and his career would have been over today. As for his part, Wiener has thus far refused to resign, but not committed to the release of the latest photo. And and what cracked me up is that...
He's such a pig.
Oh, he is. Yeah, he really is. Here it is. Now, yeah. Check this guy out. The Village Voice has the article posted, and that was the one I got. But here it is. That's the picture that he had that the woman said that he had actually released. Picture of an erect penis.
Oh.
On an iPhone.
Gosh, I wouldn't even know what it was.
And, but
picture's so bad, but I'm sure it's.
But he proved that he had the photo.
Oh,
and,
boy.
And that this woman had sent him, because all the photos that he had tweeted her.
Oh, she saved them all? Oh.
Well, she was upset, yeah, and she wanted to get back at him, and that's how she...
Oh, she sent them to somebody
she
else?
She sent them to this guy.
Oh, okay.
Who was the conservative blogger.
Oh, that's how it all came out.
That's how it came out.
Well, and rightly so.
All right. This is another interesting one that I... This is a
from the Sun. Boy 7 told playing guns is too threatening.
Yeah, I don't know why I got this, because I know you had a problem. You've had problems as a counselor with kids threatening.
Yeah, kids it's because they watch so many of these violent video games and they play them with no direction from parents, the video games of the babysitters.
Yep.
And it brings violence into our society. So you're going to wonder why we have so much violence? Well, we're training them to be violent.
And this is a short article, but it poses a debate that I think needs to be brought up. And it says, teacher told off 2 7-year-old boys playing an army game because it was threatening. The lads were spotted, this is in England, of course, the lads were spotted making gun shapes with their hands. The staff also told the pupils' parents to reprimand them. The dad of one of the boys said, "This is ridiculous. How can you tell a 7-year-old boy he can't play guns with and armies with his friends? We were told to tell our sons they cannot play guns anymore." The teacher said the boys should be reprimanded for threatening behavior, which would not be tolerated in the school. And the boys attended Nathan Newton's infants in Newtown, Warwick. Local Tory MP Marcus Jones said, "It is quite apparent the boys would be playing an innocent game. This is political correctness gone mad. When I was that age, that type of game was commonplace, and I don't remember anyone coming to any harm from it. The school defended its actions, and I said the boy indulged in unacceptable behavior. It said the boy indulged by making gun gestures to members of the staff." And a spokesman said, "Far from stopping children from playing, we actively encourage it. However, a judgment call has to be made by playing turns into unacceptable behavior."
Yeah,
so what's your take on that?
We can't have that in the school because we've had so many incidents in this country where children have brought weapons to school. And you can't, when people play that way and then they begin pointing it at adults, they begin to think that way.
Yeah.
It is not okay. There are, of all the games, there are many, many games you can play. You don't have to play that kind of game.
No, that's true. That's true.
And why practice violence? Why don't we practice peace?
Yeah, that would make sense. Huh?
Then we wonder why we have such a violent world. That's why because we practice violence.
Yeah. And it's like, U.S. to sabotage Pakistan nuclear facilities. Going rogue, NATO war crimes in Libya. All right? This stuff is really amazing. These two articles are must-reads, I think. But going rogue, NATO war crimes in Libya. It is a story CNN won't report. Late at night, there's a pounding on the door in Misrata, and armed forces forced young Libyan women out of their beds at gunpoint, hustling the women and teenagers into trucks. Soldiers rush the women to gangbang parties for NATO rebels or else rape them in front of their husbands or fathers. When NATO rebels finish their rape sport, the soldiers cut the women's throats.
Lovely.
This is NATO.
Well, they've been criticized for doing these kinds of things all over Africa.
Oh, yeah.
And they're not held accountable. They can't be tried in the country. And then they escape
actually,
by going back to
that's
their...
That's actually UN troops.
That's right.
And this is NATO, but, I'm sure they're involved.
Yeah.
Rapes are now
ongoing acts of war in rebel-held cities like an organized military strategy, according to refugees. Joanne Moriarty, who's part of the global fact-finding delegation visiting Tripoli this week, also reported that neighbor rebels have gone house to house through Misrata, asking families if they suspect NATO, support NATO. If the families say no, they are killed on the spot. If families say they want to stay out of the fighting, NATO rebels take a different approach to scare other families. The doors of neutral homes are welded shut, Moretti says, trapping families inside. In Libyan homes, windows are typically barred, so when the doors to a family compound get welded shut, Libyans are entombed in their own houses where NATO forces can be sure large families will surely starve to death. Oh, lovely. There are these are daily occurrences, not isolated events, and Gaddafi soldiers are not responsible. In fact, pro-Gaddafi and neutral families are targeted as victims of these attacks. Some of the NATO tactics may have occurred in hopes of laying the blame at Gaddafi's door. However, the attacks are backfiring. Oh, it's brutal.
Brutal bastards.
Brutal
bastards. And, flashback to Serbia. The events are eerily reminiscent of Serbia's conflict in the Balkans with its notorious rape camps. Except today, NATO itself is perpetrating these war crimes as if they had learned the worst terror tactics from their enemies. Their actions would be categorized as war crimes, just like the Serb leader Slobodan Milosevic. except the NATO, that NATO won't allow itself to face prosecution. According to NATO, international law is for the other guy. And NATO is wrong. So long as NATO governments
provide the funding and assault rifles, military training, ground advises, support vehicles and air power, they are fully responsible for the actions of their soldiers in the war zone. Libya's rebels are not a ragtag fighting force either. Thanks to NATO's largesse, financed by the U.S. and British taxpayers, they're fully decked out in military uniforms, parading through the streets with military vehicles for all the people to see. And they do see. In Washington, Congress likes to pretend that America has not become involved in the day-to-day actualities of military planning. However, refugees have observed U.S., British, French, and Israeli soldiers standing by as rebel soldiers attack civilians. Rape parties are the most graphic example of NATO's loss of moral control. One weeping father told the fact-finding delegation how a couple of weeks ago NATO rebels targeted seven separate households, kidnapping a virgin daughter from each pro-Qaddafi family. The rebels were paid for each kidnapped girl, just as they had paid for each Libyan soldier they killed. Like mercenary soldiers, they hustled the girls into trucks, took them to a building where the girls were locked in separate rooms. NATO soldiers proceeded to drink alcohol until they got very drunk. When the leader told them to rape the virgin daughters in gangbang style, when they finished raping the girls, the NATO leader told them to cut their breasts off the living girls and bring the breasts to him. Oh, I can't even read this. I can't read any more of it. It's
they
too
did this well.
Let's not read it.
They did this while the girls were alive and screaming. And all the girls died hideous deaths. Then their severed breasts were taken to a local square and arranged to spell the word whore. And the grieving father spoke to a convention of workers attended by the global fact-finding delegation. He was openly weeping, as all of us should. NATO's offenses in Libya are as terrible and unforgivable as Syria's castration and mutilation of a 13-year-old boy that shocked the world. Yet so long as NATO, the guilty party, the Western media, has looked the other way in this face. If some of us are paying attention, we can see that NATO has gone rogue in Libya, and the Libyan people themselves consider it unforgivable. Last week, 2,000 tribal leaders gathered in Tripoli to draft a constitution for the country, as demanded by British government. And notoriously, British warships and U.S. drones pounded the streets of Tripoli with bunker bombs and missiles for days and nights close to where the tribal leaders were meeting. And from Tripoli, it felt awfully like the British were trying to stop the Libyan people from bringing this constitution to life.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And then the tribal leaders condemned British aggression. Tribal backlash.
Yeah, it's very, very long article.
But I want to. I would hope that you would get this. A gone rogue NATO war crimes in Libya.
And who's that by?
This is by Ukrnet.
By Susan Lauder.
Ukrnet.
Oh, that is horrible.
It really.
I couldn't even read it. I just couldn't.
No.
It's a horrible thing that happened to those poor children.
Yeah, it is.
They were just young girls.
Yeah. And
they didn't deserve to die like that. Horrible.
I just posting this again. It was unspeakable atrocities. If anybody is listening to this show from Facebook, I just posted that on my site. So, U.S. aims to sabotage Pakistan nuclear facilities. Of course, this was stated by Ahmadinejad.
A long time ago. He's been talking about that.
Well, he's been talking about it, but this just came out on today. He says, we have accurate information that in order to regain dominance over Pakistan and weaken the country's government and nations, the Americans want to sabotage Pakistan's nuclear facilities and pave the way for the U.S.'s extended presence and the weakening of the national governing of the people through the lever of the United Nations Security Council and some international organizations, Ahmadinejad said during a press conference on Tuesday. The Iranian president noted that colonialists used the 9/11 attacks as a pretext to launch their largest military invasion on the Middle East region in order to save from destruction the ailing economy of themselves and the Zionist regime Israel as the main base of ultra-modern colonialism.
Probably enough of that.
U.S.-backed Bahrain, despite its human rights abuses. And U.S. President Barack Obama has once again expressed unwavering support for the Bahraini regime, despite international condemnation of Manama's gross human rights violations.
In a meeting with Bahraini Crown Prince Sheikh Salman bin Ahmed Al Khalifa at the White House, Obama voiced his strong support for the Crown Prince's ongoing efforts to initiate the national dialogue, a White House statement said. Earlier, U.S. Secretary of State President Clinton praised Al-Khalifa's efforts to deal with the ongoing revolution in Bahrain. Bahrain is a partner and a very important one to the United States, and we're supportive of their national dialogue and the kinds of important work that the Crown Prince has been doing in the nation, and we look forward to it, Clinton said. Meanwhile, Clinton stopped short of commenting on the Saudi-backed, heavy-handed crackdown on anti-government protests in Bahrain over the past month. Bahraini opposition groups have lashed out at the U.S. what they have described as Washington's double standard on the revolution in the Arab world. Bahraini people have been engaged in near-daily anti-government protest rallies since mid-February, calling for an end to the despotic rule of the Al-Khalifa family. Last March, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates deployed their troops to the small Persian Gulf island to help the Manama regime in its brutal crackdown on protesters.
So, we're the greatest hypocritical country there is. Doesn't get better, does it? This amazes me.
Let's go down
to
see if there's any...
No, that's... We got a few minutes left.
What's that?
That's the one we did just...
Oh, okay. We did that one.
We played that on our show. This one here, we wanted to... We never got to...
Venezuela cuts ties with the U.S., I think.
Yep.
Over Iran.
Yeah.
Venezuela has severed its relations with the U.S. after Washington imposed sanctions against Venezuela's state-owned oil company for supplying gasoline to Iran. According to Examiner.com, Venezuela officially froze relations with the United States on Sunday, a top diplomat from President Hugo Chavez's government said.
Not surprisingly, nothing mentioned.
Yeah, nothing mentioned the other way. Venezuelan Foreign Minister Nicolas Maduro also hinted that reestablishing relations with the U.S. would be impossible. On May 24th, the U.S. imposed sanctions against Venezuela's giant oil company, Petroleos de Venezuela, for providing Iran with gasoline and other refined oil products. Under the sanction, PDVSA, that's the oil company, is denied U.S. government contracts and banned from Washington's export financing. Maduro has earlier described the sanctions as illegal, abusive measures taken by this weak government of the United States.
Venezuela Energy Minister Rafael Ramirez, who is also the head of PDVSA, said on May 25th that Venezuela would continue to maintain relations with Iran and any other country it wants. This is a right we are not going to renounce, Ramirez says. And approximately 26% of Venezuela's imports are from the United States. Venezuela is one of the United States' main suppliers of petroleum, selling at about 1 million barrels of oil per day. And the UN Security Council adopted a 4 rounds of sanctions after Tehran in 2010 under intense pressure from the U.S. which claims Iran's nuclear program may have potential military aspects. Iran has repeatedly refuted the allegations.
Mm.
Do you want to read the rest there? Shortly after
the UN sanctions, the U.S. imposed fresh unilateral sanctions against Iran's financial and energy sectors, encouraging other countries to abandon investments in the Iranian market. Under the imposed measures, U.S. firms are banned from carrying out trade exchanges, importing from and exporting goods to Iran and making ventures in the country. Foreign banks and corporations doing business with Iran could be denied access to the U.S. Export-Import Bank. Your ability to sell in the U.S. market would be restricted, and we'd be denied U.S. government contracts. Iran says that as a member of the International Atomic Energy Agency and a signatory to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, there's the right to use peaceful applications of nuclear energy for electricity generation and medical research. You got to close that window. We suddenly got a storm here, folks, and we had an open window that we had to close.
Well, we're getting nearer to the end, but we will continue here for a minute. See where we're going. You want to read this one?
Afghan forces to protect gas pipeline in a bid to provide security for the Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India gas pipeline. The Afghan government plans to hire 12,000 military forces. Initially, Afghanistan officials originally planned to hire 7,000 forces, but decided to increase the number to 12,000 after further investigations and evaluating threats. Afghanistan's mines and industry minister, Walhalidullah Shahrani, said, "Insecurity is the biggest challenge the TAPI pipeline faces in Afghanistan," he added. Oh, no kidding. Oh, he's enlightened, huh?
Yeah, enlightened.
And this is from Press TV?
Yeah, this is why we went to war in Afghanistan.
Uh-huh.
Originally, it was to secure this pipeline. Yeah. So.
In 2010, Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India signed a final agreement to build the TAPI gas pipeline, intended to carry gas to India from Central Asian states. The Turkmenistan, which holds the world's fourth largest nuclear gas reserves, is keen to revive plans to build the pipeline through Afghanistan to acquire access...
Natural gas. Nuclear gas.
Did I say nuclear? To Pakistan and India's markets. The project, partially financed by Asian Development Bank, envisages the building of the 1,700-kilometer pipeline with total gas capacity of 90 million cubic meters per day. The TAPI gas pipeline will cross Afghanistan's southwest provinces of Kandahar and Helmand, which are under the influences of the Taliban, as well as some of Pakistan's unruly tribal areas. The project has also won vocal support from the U.S., which was strongly opposed to India and Pakistan drawing supplies from Iran through Iran-Pakistan-India gas pipeline project. India and Pakistan faced intense pressure from the U.S. over the IPI, or the peace pipeline. Iran has not officially reacted to the construction of the TAPI gas pipeline so far.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's kind of interesting, I thought, but,
We're
at the end of the show.
So we want to thank people.
Yeah, I want to really thank everybody for joining us. And let's see if I can get out of here for a second. Yeah.
We hope to.
Yeah.
Leo will be talking to you tomorrow, and I'll be talking to you again next Tuesday.
Yes.
And I hope you have a great night.
Yes.
Thanks for listening, folks.
All right, everybody. Good night. Have a great week. And please join me tomorrow night as I venture into the fourth dimension.